loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker. Donald Trump is promising fire and fury in response to reports that North Korea has developed the ability to miniaturize a nuclear warhead so that it can be placed on a missile. North Korea is vowing to stay the course and fiercely defend its sovereignty. A senior war crimes prosecutor is resigning from a United Nations panel investigating human rights abuses in Syria, saying that now, quote, everyone is bad. Meanwhile, forces aligned with the Syrian government are making progress against terrorist organizations on the battlefield. As the Trump administration passes the 200-day mark, the increasingly embattled White House is struggling to maintain its core of support. Divisions within the Republican Party are deepening, along with dissatisfaction with the two-party establishment as a whole. But first, we turn to Korea. We are joined from Columbus, Ohio, by Gregory Ilitch. He is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea and the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit. Welcome back, Gregory.
Thank you for inviting me.
So the breaking news this afternoon is that in response to news that the Defense Intelligence Agency has assessed that North Korea has the ability to miniaturize a nuclear warhead, meaning that it has the ability to put it on a missile. Donald Trump released this, I would say, extremely disturbing statement. It reads, North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening, and I suppose here he refers to Kim Jong-un. He has been very threatening beyond the normal state, and as I said, they will be met with fire and fury and, frankly, power the likes of which this world has never seen before. What's your reaction to that?
Stunned, actually. Just heard the news moments ago, actually. Unfortunately, the Trump administration has shown no inclination to engage in diplomacy, which, and I don't think they're going to accept the status quo. So it seems like it's a strong worry that they're going down this road of military adventurism that could result in hundreds of thousands of deaths. And it is indeed deeply disturbing. But it's kind of ironic that Trump would talk about North Korean threats, because all they've done is tested weapon systems the same as any other country has done. So, for instance, on the ICBMs, they fired two. The U.S. this year has fired three ICBM tests. So why is it a threat when North Korea does this, but not when the United States does that? And of course, then there's also the factor of the U.S. flying B-1 bombers near North Korea's border as a threat. But that's apparently doesn't qualify as a threat. So actually, North Korea has done nothing to threaten the United States. It's the other way around.
Yeah, the hypocrisy really is stunning. I mean, let's try to read between the lines here. I mean, when Trump says fire and fury, I mean, what do you think he's referring to? I mean, of course, a war on the Korean Peninsula would be absolutely devastating. I mean, many, like you said, hundreds of thousands of people. I think that's certainly reasonable to say would perish. I mean, when he says fire and fury, is he perhaps talking about a nuclear strike? I mean, is he talking about a conventional strike? How do you interpret that?
I don't think a nuclear strike would be on the table. The reaction from the world public would just be too outraged, frankly. But the U.S. has such strong conventional arms capability that it could basically inflict the same equivalent amount of damage on North Korea through conventional means only. So, and that's what I think Trump means, a sustained bombing campaign to begin with, and perhaps followed by troops invading. But I think he has in mind for sure bombing if he goes down that road.
Right. And North Korea also has a conventional deterrent. I mean, most of the news is about the nuclear deterrent that they're trying to develop. But I mean, the artillery, the rocket systems lined up along the border. I mean, it would not just be the U.S. inflicting massive casualties on the targeted country like they're used to doing, you know, say in Libya, in Iraq, you know, going back maybe in Yugoslavia and Serbia. This would be a war in which large numbers of U.S. troops would die. I mean, in addition to many, many thousands of Koreans, right?
Yeah, I think the experience of U.S. had with Yugoslavia and Libya and Iraq has given it a false sense of invulnerability. So I'm not sure that the U.S. planners are really taking into consideration that U.S. troops would perhaps die in large numbers in South Korea as well. And I think North Korea has now the capability of hitting the U.S. strategic bomber force in Guam, and I don't think they would hesitate to do so if they're going to be under attack.
And what's the significance of these military installations in East Asia? There's the U.S. Bombers in Guam. There's, military bases in Japan, of course, military bases throughout South Korea. This massive buildup of military forces in the Pacific, in East Asia, it's pointed at North Korea. It's the, a dagger pointed at North Korea, but it's also directed towards China, correct?
That's my take on it also. I think that North Korea is just a pretext for the U.S. to build up a military encirclement of China, just as it's basically encircling Russia as well.
Right. And well, tell us about the new sanctions that were imposed on North Korea by the United Nations. I mean, what do they do? What do they prohibit? And since we're speaking about China, I mean, I just want to stick with that for a second. I mean, the vote was unanimous. It was 15-0 on the Security Council. China could have exercised its veto power as one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, but it did not. So tell us about the sanctions, and then tell us, if you would, why you think China went along with them this time.
Sure. So according to the Western media, they'd have you believe that these sanctions are targeted at North Korea's nuclear program, and it's intended to encourage North Korea to return to talks. But when you look at the actual text of the UN sanctions, it's nothing of the kind. It's purely economic targets. So, for instance, it bans North Korea from exporting coal, iron ore, lead ore, and seafood. One third of its export earnings come from those commodities. So these have no military utility whatsoever. This purely normal trade. It also prohibits new joint ventures with North Korea and investment in existing joint ventures. That basically kills off any possibility of South Korea reopening the Kaesong Industrial Complex, which was at one time the key method that South Korea had for warming relations with North Korea. So that's dead now.
And that industrial complex, it's North Korean workers, it's coupled with South Korean investment, and it was the result of the Sunshine policy of increased dialogue and cooperation that prevailed in, I believe, the late 90s. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, later than that, under the Noh Moo-hyung government in South Korea, which was about a decade ago. And, of course, that was killed off during subsequent conservative rule in South Korea. But that was actually supposed to be just the opening measure. So at the end of the Noh Moo-hyung government, he also signed a number of agreements with North Korea on joint mining ventures. And that was killed off by the conservative who succeeded him, Lee Myung-bak.
So take us inside the calculations of the Chinese leadership in agreeing to these tough new sanctions. I mean, certainly, I think when we consider the extremely threatening and menacing statement that Donald Trump just released, we could maybe conclude that China's acquiescence here on the issue of the sanctions a few days ago has perhaps even emboldened the Trump administration to go further in its aggression.
Yeah, I believe so. And actually, before I get to that, I want to mention one other thing, that main point from the sanctions, that the sanctions that were just passed blacklists North Korea's foreign trade bank, which was their primary means of international trade and earning and handling foreign exchange, and also blacklisted the Korea Credit Development Bank. So again, this is an economic target. But I was actually disappointed that China and Russia didn't push back more on these sanctions. Apparently, there were negotiations where the U.S. was trying to also get oil embargo included as one of the elements of these sanctions, and China did succeed on getting that removed. However, these sanctions are still so draconian in nature, it's it's, as you say, I think it did embolden the U.S. that China and Russia went along with that. So why did they? I think on one hand, China is worried that the U.S. is using North Korea as a pretext to build up its military. So it's it thinks if it goes along and it might slow that process down. But I did notice also in the South Korean media, there was a report that last month that the U.S.-China Comprehensive Economic Dialogue, U.S. officials pulled the Chinese officials aside and threatened them that if they did not agree to vote in favor of these sanctions, that the U.S. would unilaterally sanction every Chinese business and individual who does normal business with North Korea. And I assume that probably similar threats were made against Russia. So I there was definitely a threat of economic damage directed at China if it did not go along.
Right, right. And just to tell us, the audience, what the purpose of these sanctions are. I mean, you said, you know, it's a result of a desire to place economic pressure on the country. It's not targeted at the nuclear program. And sometimes there's this counterposing of sanctions to military action, right? It's like, we don't want war. We want to use diplomacy. We want to use sanctions. But sanctions really are a form of economic war, right?
Oh, absolutely. So it's ironic to me where when I hear Trump administration officials saying, we're only going to give diplomacy a few more months. Well, I don't call sanctions diplomacy by any means. It's like another form of warfare. It imposes a tremendous amount of damage. So I was in Iraq in 2000 and in Yugoslavia in 1999 and saw firsthand what sanctions does to a country. It just imposes massive suffering on the entire population. It's a collective punishment, in effect. It destroys lives across the board. This is not diplomacy by any stretch of the imagination.
Now, like we've said, the country, the DPRK, North Korea, has a very large conventional army, a very large conventional deterrent. That takes a lot of resources to maintain, right? So in addition to a nuclear arsenal being a strong deterrent just by itself in a vacuum, is there an economic reason why the DPRK looks to a nuclear deterrent as opposed to a massive conventional force?
Yeah, absolutely. I forget the Korean name for this, but there's a policy.
That's it.
So North Korea has announced this is their policy. They want to improve the economy and develop the economy. And of course, I think if I remember correctly, 25% of the North Korean finances go into supporting the army, which conventional armies are tremendously expensive, and they obviously can't afford that. And of course, the conventional arms can't stand up to the advanced technology that the U.S. has to offer, let alone South Korea. So if they develop a nuclear deterrent, this would allow them to greatly reduce the size of their conventional army and conventional arms, which actually would be free up a lot of money for the to build up the economy. So it's ironic when you hear U.S. officials say, well, North Korea's wasting money on these nuclear arms when they could be using it to help the people. Well, it's the opposite, really. It's the nuclear arms would free up money to build up the economy.
Right. And you, UN ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, made just that point, which I agree is really a nonsensical point. Following the passage of the sanctions in the UN Security Council, she said it was a gut punch to North Korea to let them know the international community is tired of it and we're going to start fighting back. Every dollar of revenue that the North Korean government gets, they're not feeding their people with it. They're using it towards a nuclear weapons system. Going after these sanctions is going after their ability to build these missiles. I mean, there's several pretty ridiculous assertions there. I mean, what do you think? Is little North Korea bullying the superpower United States, or is it really the other way around?
Well, obviously, it's the other way around. I mentioned before the B-1 bombers flying near North Korea's border to send a signal that the U.S. is willing to carpet bomb North Korean cities. And, of course, they conduct large-scale military exercises with South Korea on a regular basis, including units practicing what they call decapitation strikes, that is, infiltrating soldiers into North Korea and assassinating North Korean officials. You can imagine if some nation was doing the same, say, in the Caribbean with joint exercise with Cuba, practicing the bombing of the U.S. and invasion of the U.S. and assassination of U.S. officials, what the reaction would be over here. But so it's not the North Korea that's threatening the United States. It's the other way around.
We just have a couple minutes left. I want to turn to the situation in South Korea. President Moon Jae-in was elected in the wake of the candlelight revolution that forced the right-wing Park Geun-hye administration out of office. Moon Jae-in was widely regarded as somebody who favors dialogue and diplomacy with the North as opposed to confrontation. What's really happening now? I mean, are progressive people in South Korea becoming disappointed, disillusioned with the Moon Jae-in administration?
And that's exactly what I'm hearing from people who have contacts with South Korean progressive forces. There's a lot of disappointment, and rightly so. So Moon Jae-in has caved in completely, starting from his visit to the U.S. to meet with Trump and signing on to Trump's policy of increasing pressure. And like Trump, Moon Jae-in has said that there should be no negotiations unless North Korea denuclearizes as a precondition. So this is a way of avoiding diplomacy. On the other side, I'm speculating that Moon Jae-in is thinking that if he caves in on everything else, that maybe he can talk Trump out of military action. But I don't think that would be effective.
Right. So just trying to avert the very worst option.
Yes.
So you mentioned, the advanced U.S. munitions in South Korea, the advanced U.S. weapon systems that could be deployed against the North. In the last minute or two that we have, tell us what the THAAD system is and how does that play into all these tensions that we've been talking about?
Okay, THAAD, Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. It's an anti-missile system that the U.S. has just installed in South Korea. So the radar that goes with the THAAD has two modes. It has a forward-based mode that can feed the signal to the missiles and supposedly shoot down incoming missiles. And has a forward-based setting where it can track missiles from a long distance away, say, fired from China. And then it can feed those signals to U.S. missile systems in Alaska or the western coast. So this would actually be part of the U.S. military anti-missile system. It's basically intended to give the U.S. a first-strike capability, where if it knocks out most of the Chinese missiles, the few that would remain that could be shot down by U.S. missiles in the western U.S. and Alaska, and the THAAD would give it the initial tracking ability. So the closer you are to the launch site, the more accurate the missiles are when they try to shoot down an incoming missile.
That is all the time we have left. We've been joined from Columbus, Ohio by Gregory Ehlich. He is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea and the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit. Thank you so much for joining us, Gregory. You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
Welcome back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker. A senior war crimes prosecutor is resigning from a United Nations panel investigating human rights abuses in Syria, saying now, quote, everyone is bad. Meanwhile, forces aligned with the Syrian government are making progress against terrorist organizations on the battlefield. We are joined from Spain by Alberto Garcia Watson, a journalist and former senior Middle East correspondent for Hispan TV. Welcome back, Alberto.
Thanks for having me.
There's been some highly significant developments in recent days in Syria. Who's winning the war right now and who's losing? And tell us about the resignation of war crimes prosecutor Carla Del Ponte.
Well, starting with Carla Del Ponte, it has taken by surprise most of people. She's been, from the very beginning, leading this Commission for Human Rights in the Syrian conflict. And it's, as I said, a lot of up and downs. There's been a lot of... we heard the narrative that we heard in Libya. We heard that from the very beginning, from March 2011 that al-Assad was bombing and killing his people. We heard the same about Gaddafi in Libya. We hear now the same about Maduro in Venezuela. It repeats over and over, and it doesn't take by surprise the fact that the United Nations always points or usually points in the wrong direction and makes bad who probably is not that bad and makes good who actually happens to be mean. So at this point, it's sad to hear that somebody that has been working so hard in this conflict, that knows very, very well what's going on, resigns, because at this stage, I don't know who's going to take over and what kind of a role it's going to implement in the United Nations. However, I think that this woman has tried very, very hard, has had the West against her at one point, then it was pro her, then she had to follow the narrative at a certain point. What I think is a real pity is that she believes that everyone is bad. What I can say, actually, being in Syria, the times that I have been there during the war, is that it's a big mess. Everyone is getting involved. There are different interests involved in the conflict. We have the Gulf nations, the Gulf monarchies involved. We have Turkey, we have Israel, who nobody talks about. We have the United States. Definitely Russia is also involved. And the Syrian people, at this point, I have to say that actually are more or less happy with the situation, because they're winning the war. The war is being won by the Syrian forces with the help of the Russians. And not much more, because to be honest, the American intervention at this point is making more of a mess. We haven't heard in the media about the one of the last bombings of the U.S. forces over a hospital in Raqqa using a white phosphorus that killed over 30 civilians. As I said, it's a very, very big mess what is going on. And I believe that Clara Del Ponte has just end up being absolutely exhausted, not knowing where to point at, who is responsible, and seeing that eventually the United Nations is playing a role that is not finding any solutions in this conflict.
Now, that's incredible. I mean, the United States dropped white phosphorus on a hospital. Tell us a little bit more about that incident in particular, if you would, because if the roles were reversed, if it was the Syrian government dropping chemical weapons, with white phosphorus is a chemical weapon, a deadly illegal weapon, it would be front page news in all the Western corporate media outlets. So tell us more about that incident.
Well, this is not the first time that the U.S. Uses white phosphorus. They use white phosphorus in the battle, in the first and the second battle for Fallujah in 2004, in the Iraq war. They have used it in Mosul. They used it just a couple of weeks ago, and they used it again the last weekend over this hospital in Raqqa. Raqqa is it's a stronghold of ISIS in northern Syria, and is a very, very strong battle going on at this point. And unfortunately, the United States, who hasn't been invited to this war by any means, by no one, absolutely no one in the conflict, is using methods that is proving not to be, first, not to be legal, and second, not to be efficient. They show the worst side in the battle for Mosul, where hundreds of people had been killed, the majority of them civilians. And it seems like the Air Force does not care very much, the U.S. Air Force, in destroying civilian, heavily populated areas and hospitals like it happened. The fact that they're using white phosphorus, like Israel used it in the 2008-2009 cast lead operation over the Gaza Strip, seems to not be enough to be condemned by the United Nations, and it's usually blamed on Syria, who we know has no chemical weapons after the 2014 getting rid of all these weapons after what happened in East Ghouta in August 2013. So what is going on now in Raqqa, again, I mean, hundreds of people are dying almost on a daily basis. Many are militant, obviously. Many of them are insurgents of the Islamic State. But at the same time, it's collateral damage, as the U.S. will say, which are hundreds and hundreds of civilians that are used very, very often as human shields.
So the resignation of Del Ponte, these atrocities that the U.S.-led coalition is responsible for that you just detailed, that undercuts one of the key narratives that we've seen in the Western media and coming from Western capitals over the course of this war, which is the narrative of the people versus the evil dictator. One other key narrative with which the Western governments sell the war in Syria or sell intervention in the war in Syria is the moderate rebels versus the extremists. Do you buy that? I mean, is there such a thing as the quote-unquote moderate opposition in Syria?
I've been several times in Syria, and when you talk to the people in Syria, when you talk to the Syrians about moderate rebels and extremist rebels or insurgents, they laugh. They laugh because there's no such thing as moderate rebels. From the very beginning, the West has been arming, financing, and training the Free Syrian Army. But there are reports of the Free Syrian Army. You can even go into YouTube and find photographs in Google proving and showing how the Free Syrian Army is beheading people. It's a famous image of this commander of the Free Syrian Army, the first or the second year of the start of the war, where he cuts the heart of a dead Syrian soldier and he starts eating that heart in front of the cameras. This actually was a commander of the Free Syrian Army. Then there was another Free Syrian Army cell that shot down a Syrian helicopter, beheaded all the pilots and personnel that were in that helicopter, and they grilled their heads in a barbecue. And they even showed it and with photographs. I mean, this proves that actually most of the groups, and not entirely the groups, are extremists. The Free Syrian Army started being, to a certain extent, secular. But at this point, the mostly Islamists, Wahhabists, and fully with Saudis and Qataris and from all over the place except Syrians. So it's ridiculous to talk about moderate and to talk about extremists. At this point, the majority of them are terrorists and mercenaries that have been brought into Syria actually to for the interests of some nations, as I mentioned before, especially the Gulf monarchies, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, that are interested in installing an extremist emirate that will actually eventually will promote and will facilitate the building of this gas pipe from Qatar into Turkey and into Europe.
So let's turn to some battlefield developments now. We've already talked about what's going on in Raqqa in northern Syria. That's certainly one of the major battles going on. But tell us about the Syrian government's capture of al-Sukna. What's the significance of this?
Well, al-Sukna was a stronghold in Homs. And just last Sunday, I think it was the 9th or the 8th, the 6th. It was taken by the Syrian forces with the help of the Russian air forces and helicopters. That was a stronghold that the extremists of Daesh were holding on to, because it's a very logistically important. It's essential to have that position in central Syria. And hundreds of insurgents have died in this battle because they really wanted to keep hold of it. Now they lost it. It was really important. Homs is now finally liberated. Well, in the U.S. narrative, it would have been like Aleppo. It had fallen. Liberated would have been Mosul. But in this case, no longer insurgents of Daesh are still operating in Homs. Homs is actually a very, very important strategic location in the center of Syria. And from this point on, the Syrian army is going to have a much easier way of fighting the rest of the cells of Daesh in Syria, which have lost a lot of territory in the past month.
And al-Sukna is relatively near Deir ez-Zor, correct? I mean, is Deir ez-Zor a country in the, in the eastern part of the country? Is that the next target for the Syrian government's offensive as they take back more and more territory from ISIS?
Well, Deir ez-Zor is a very important city. I actually should have visited that city 1.5 years ago, but the insurgents were really taking positions around the military airport that it's in Deir ez-Zor, which it was the only spot that actually was in control of the Syrian forces. Deir ez-Zor at this point, it's under very strong bombardment. And for the Syrians, it's very important to capture and liberate that city because of the closeness to the Syrian-Iraqi border. And however, it's actually also quite close to Raqqa. But Deir ez-Zor, if just in April, the past April, again, the Syrian army had cornered cells of the Daesh, of the Islamic State, and eventually the U.S. forces, by mistake, bombed that that location, killing 107 or 127 Syrian soldiers, facilitating that the Islamic State will take that position again. So this kind of accidents usually always grant the wrong side. So hopefully the United States Air Force stops committing these mistakes for the sake of the fight and the struggle against terrorism in Syria. Because as I said, every time they get involved, every time they bomb a Syrian position, again, by mistake, the extremists of Daesh usually take over that position. This is no mistake, obviously. This is no coincidence. The United States is playing very often as the air force of the Islamic State, like Israel in the Golan Heights area is playing the air force for Al-Qaeda and Jabhat al-Nusra every time that Hezbollah or the Syrian army corners Al-Qaeda cells near the Golan Heights, the Syrian Golan Heights. So again, this is no coincidence. It seems that it repeats over and over. As I said at the beginning, nobody has invited the United States in this conflict. And unfortunately, it's messing up the whole situation. They should let actually the Syrians decide their future and let the Syrian army, the Arab Syrian army, which is the only legitimate army actually to operate there, or those that the Syrians decide they want them to help, like the Russians or like the Iranis or the Shia militia from the Lebanon, Hezbollah.
Yeah, let's stick with Hezbollah for a moment because they've launched and, in fact, I believe have been successful in a major offensive along the Lebanese-Syrian border. Tell us about that battle. Who was Hezbollah fighting? What were their objectives? What was the ultimate outcome?
Well, to be honest, I have to say that I was in Arsal, which is the main city in the Kalamun, in the Lebanese Kalamun mountain region, where actually Al-Qaeda and ISIS had taken positions in August 2014. I happened to be there because the Lebanese army were taking positions, trying to get this hills where were taken by the Islamists, and eventually they lost 25 of their soldiers. They were kidnapped, some of them by the Jabhat al-Nusra of Al-Qaeda, and the other group by ISIS. I had to visit several times as a correspondent in Lebanon this area. Every time that we visited, we were attacked, not just us, but other media outlets too. And eventually, with the intervention of Hezbollah, which at that time was not getting involved because it seemed to have been an agreement that since Hezbollah is a Shia militia and Arsal is mostly populated by Sunni Muslims, it would have represented a provocation, the presence of Hezbollah in Arsal. So knowing actually how weak the Lebanese army has always been, and they've been very weak, even though they have tried to get weapons and arms to defend their borders from the terrorists, Israel has never allowed it because they always claim that the Lebanese army, who happens to be at war still with Israel, would actually have such weapons. They might be used against Israel or through Hezbollah to attack Israel, which it's actually quite ridiculous at this point because Lebanon needs these weapons. Lebanon is a target, is the way out to the sea that Daesh has always had interest in to get more militants to sell the oil that they've been stealing from Syria and from Iraq, that eventually was bought by Turkish interests. And as I say, Lebanon needed these weapons to actually be able to confront these terrorist attacks, which at the time that I was in Lebanon happened almost on a daily basis.
One last question, because we only have about 1 minute left. I just want you to briefly tell us about the situation in Idlib. I mean, Tahrir al-Sham, which is the newest iteration of al-Qaeda, seems to have seized control of the province and the capital city of the same name, Idlib, in the northwest of Syria. I mean, will Turkey intervene in Idlib? What's going to happen there?
Turkey has been keeping a very ambiguous position in this conflict from the very beginning. As I mentioned before, the border had always been open for the infiltration of insurgents from any other country around the world into Syria. They always kept the borders open for weapons and terrorists coming into Syria. So I'm not very sure if Turkey really has a interest of attacking Idlib, because most of the Islamists that are now inside that city, actually many of which came out of Aleppo and now also from the Kalamun area and from other sites, are actually quite strong, and they're keeping that stronghold, as I say, very strongly away from the possibilities of the Syrian army still at this stage.
We are absolutely out of time. Thank you so much, Alberto Garcia Watson, for joining us. Alberto Garcia Watson is a journalist and former senior Middle East correspondent for Hispan TV. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. This is Walter Smolarek filling in for Brian Becker. As the Trump administration passes the 200-day mark, the increasingly embattled White House is struggling to maintain its core of support. Divisions within the Republican Party are deepening, along with dissatisfaction with the two-party establishment as a whole. We are joined from New York by award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist Ted Rall. Welcome back, Ted.
Thanks, Walter.
So Donald Trump is dealing with some brutal poll numbers today from a newly released survey by the opinion research company SSRS. Trump's had a pretty remarkably consistent base of support, but now that we're past the 200-day mark, I just want to read you some of these statistics and see if you think that that sort of hard core of support is perhaps beginning to slip away. I mean, so overall, it says that the Trump administration's approval rating is at 38% as opposed to 56% who disapprove. So 30% of respondents said that they trust nothing the White House says, and that's matched by just 24% of voters who say they trust all or most of what the administration says. And then here's maybe the more interesting part. The number of Republicans who report strongly approving of Trump, it's now at 59%, and that's opposed to 73% from February. White voters without college degrees, Trump's seen a fall of 12 percentage points in his approval reading there. And the number of people who say they feel less confident about Trump's abilities to lead because of some of these recent episodes, some of these this recent like drama with the shakeups, his behavior, it rose from 53% to 62%. So what do you think? Is Trump really starting to see his base decline?
He is Richard Nixon, and it's either late 1973 or it's early 1974. And August is closer than it was back in the 70s. This is a president whose support, by historical standards, is definitely eroding at a rapid rate. The floor seems to have begun to erode, as you mentioned, in his base of support. There was conventional wisdom, and I subscribed to it in this respect, said that he could pretty much count on about 35% of the electorate no matter what, even if he were to shoot someone on Fifth Avenue. But that appears to now be looking a little shaky. So we are looking at a president that that really kind of has this remarkable situation of having control of both houses of Congress, not having been found guilty of anything, and yet really just mostly, I would argue, mostly based on issues of temperament alone, is really sinking as fast as Richard Nixon did after the Watergate scandal really exploded.
Yeah, I agree with you that a lot of these problems are self-inflicted. But I mean, in all fairness, we have to say that, you know, the bulk of the corporate media is opposed to Trump, not on the basis of his, you know, extremely right-wing policy positions necessarily, but because, you know, he's unpresidential. He has besmirched the office of the presidency, which they held in such high regard. I mean, so Trump's been combative too, right? He tweeted yesterday, "How much longer will the failing NY Times, with its big losses and massive unfunded liability and non-existent sources, remain in business?" So, I mean, how much of this drop in his approval rating and his poll numbers do you attribute to hostile media coverage?
Well, I mean, there's no denying that you can't really govern this country with the continuous hostility of the media after you. Richard Nixon, again, could tell you all about that. And it's true that the media has been consistently, with the exception of the Fox News Breitbart base, has been hostile to him, extremely hostile, not like anything we've ever seen before. This Russia story, or I should say the extremely unsourced Russia story, which Trump is right about when he says that there's just nothing but anonymous sources, it's eating away at his poll numbers among voters who are working 50 hours a week and maybe don't have a lot of time to carefully read between the lines of every article to say, hey, wait a minute, there's not a whole lot of there. So there's unforced errors, there's the hostility of the media. You know, what's remarkable in all this is that it's supposed to be the economy, stupid, and the economy's not doing too bad. So, you know, from that point of view, maybe that's either preventing the numbers from sinking faster than ever, or maybe what I really think is going on is that we're looking at it just a completely different paradigm, given the fact that he's a completely different kind of president.
He is, and he's been certainly more willing to pick fights with members of the Senate, you know, other politicians than perhaps any other president has been. What do you make of Trump's high-profile dispute with Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal? I mean, I just want to read some of these recent tweets because they're just so kind of breathtaking. So Donald Trump, the president, tweeted, "I think Senator Blumenthal should take a nice long vacation in Vietnam where he lied about his service so he can at least say he was there. Never in U.S. history has anyone lied or defrauded voters like Senator Richard Blumenthal. He told stories about his Vietnam battles and conquests, how brave he was, and was all a lie. He cried like a baby and begged for forgiveness like a child. Now he judges collusion," in reference to the so-called Russiagate investigation. You know, this isn't the first time, of course, that Trump's been in one of these, like, Twitter feuds. I mean, is this a sideshow, or over time are these kind of bizarre confrontations taking a toll on his administration's ability to function?
Well, I mean, it's just so hard to know where to come down on this, because on the one hand, yeah, it's absolutely bizarre to have a president climbing into the gutter like this and acting like a common Twitter troll. And at the same time, you know, part of me thinks it's really hilarious, and I kind of love it. I mean, everything he says about Blumenthal is true, and I can imagine that his hardcore base of support loves it too. And it's a different world. I think no matter where you stand politically, you can imagine having a president as aggressive as Trump standing up for your point of view and the policy prescriptions that you care about. So it stands to reason that if you're a Trump supporter, you're loving this. You're like, here's this guy. He's not compromising. He's willing to get his hands dirty as if he were back in the WWE wrestling ring and not take any guff from this guy, Blumenthal, who's pontificating about him. But on the other hand, it just isn't presidential. And I think maybe more to a broader point, it's not leaderly. I don't care what kind of political system you live under, whether it's authoritarianism or democracy or parliamentary democracy or monarchy, it doesn't matter. Leaders just can't act like this. And one of the main rules of power is that you never punch down. And Trump loves to punch down. It just is very unseemly.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. I mean, if we think about the optics of this, maybe it's not quite as bad for Trump as we might think, because I mean, Richard Blumenthal is like your classic corporate Wall Street Democrat, right? I mean, the optics of Trump, the populist getting in a confrontation with this rich Democrat from Connecticut, is maybe not so bad. And, you know, there are other sort of like establishment type figures. Jeff Flake from Arizona, he's a Republican, but he's been more or less openly criticizing Donald Trump. Dean Heller is another one of these, I mean, if you can call them centrist Republicans, you know, less extremely right wing than the rest of the Republicans. He's now facing a primary challenger that was announced this morning. Danny Tarkanian, who's more ardently pro-Trump than him, will be primarying him in the 2018 election. So do you think that the establishment Republicans are going to break with Trump in a profound way, or maybe pro-Trump primary challengers are going to upset, you know, whatever unity is left within the Republican Party?
Well, at this point, I'd have to say my money is not would not necessarily be on Donald Trump even being in the primary, or perhaps not even in the White House by the spring of 2020. So, but I think if I were, certainly we are seeing the Republican establishment breaking away from Trump in a big way. You know, like the figures you mentioned, John McCain has long been a critic of Trump and an enemy of Trump. And he really got his revenge when he cast one of the deciding votes against the repeal of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And it's, I think you can argue that there is kind of a combination of the corporate mainline Republican Party is rejecting this invasion of the Donald Trump organism into this particular petri dish that is called the Washington Beltway, coupled with a little dash of, or more than a little, certainly a dash of deep state interventionism. It's sort of a quiet coup, what the CIA and other intelligence agencies have been doing by feeding just one anonymous report after another about this Russia story that has become a story, even though there's no sourcing that anybody can check out or verify.
And these transcripts, the phone calls of Trump and foreign leaders, you know, the transcripts being leaked. I mean, that kind of must have been the intelligence agencies, right?
It had to be, I think, not 100%, but they would be the first suspect. I mean, otherwise you have to assume that someone in the White House like Bannon leaked these things. And I can't imagine anyone being brave enough to do that because it would come back to them. So yeah, these intercepts definitely sound like something that came out of the NSA or some other equivalent agency. And if I were Trump, I would be feeling squeezed on all sides. He needs to find, if I were advising him, I would say he needs to find the simple strength that derives from the fact that he, against all odds, he was elected president of the United States, and now he won, and now it's his job, and he's got to stop relitigating the 2016 election and how many people attended his inauguration and roll up his sleeves and get to work. But he just doesn't seem to be his personality.
Okay, so you're saying that Donald Trump may be impeached before his term is up. I mean, I could see that happening. I don't think that's unreasonable, but let's talk about what Trump could possibly do to turn things around. I mean, if that possibility even exists. I mean, it looks like tax reform is going to be the next big push. I want to read from a Politico article that was published earlier today. The Trump White House is quietly courting a few dozen House Democrats on tax reform, eager to avoid the fate of the GOP's straight party line attempt to jam through a repeal of Obamacare. Even as congressional GOP leaders largely embrace a partisan path on taxes, White House officials have been wooing 15 to 20 centrist House Democrats since early summer. So, I mean, they want to learn the lessons of their fiasco, their failed attempt to repeal the ACA. But, I mean, is tax reform really a winning issue for Trump? Like, does that have the type of magnitude required to turn things around when it's gone so poorly for him these last 6 months?
I don't think it does. The last time the tax code was reformed in a radical way was under Reagan in 1986. And that's not really what Reagan is remembered for. It didn't give him much of a boost in the polls at the time. He was in the midst of the Iran-Contra scandal. It didn't really give him much of a lift. It's a pocketbook issue, but I think unless, ironically, the tax reform that would give Trump the kind of lift that he needs is not the kind of tax reform that the Republican Party could get behind. It would have to be broad-based. It would have to put a significant amount of cash into a lot of voters' pockets. And that's just not what the GOP is about these days, nor has it been about that for decades. This is about cutting rates for corporations and for the wealthy, not ordinary people. And unfortunately, there just aren't enough wealthy people or wealthy individuals to make a big difference to him. So I think if I were looking to score major points and I were in the Trump White House, I would be pushing hard on the infrastructure program that he promised that had wide bipartisan support that everyone agrees is what is needed, would create a lot of economic activity. And even if someone you know doesn't get a job, you're going to get to drive over that brand new bridge or through a brand new tunnel or ride a new train. And everyone's going to love that. Those are legacy projects that serve their presidents very well. I mean, it's still the Eisenhower interstate highway system, and it would be the Trump whatever system. If I were him, that's where I'd be pushing.
Now, outside of tax reform and infrastructure, I think there's a much more dangerous direction that Trump could possibly go. So this morning, he sent out a tweet celebrating his administration's success in pushing through new sanctions against North Korea. He said, "After many years of failure, countries are coming together to finally address the dangers posed by North Korea. We must be tough and decisive." So, you know, Trump saw in April when he launched, you know, dozens of cruise missiles against the airbase in Syria, the Syrian government airbase, that, you know, his elite critics kind of shut up or maybe even turn into cheerleaders for his administration when he carries out an act of aggression on the international stage. Do you think it's possible this scenario, Trump goes for a major confrontation, perhaps even a war with North Korea to save his presidency?
It's a time-honored way to boost your poll numbers, as pretty much every president can attest. So I could definitely see that. He's very bellicose. On the other hand, it's interesting because at the same time, there's this isolationist strain, not only in Trump's personal politics, but that also in his base, in the Tea Party base that brought him to power, that wants to put America first. So that could really cut either way. I mean, Trump probably took careful note of the fact that the Iraq war turned into a disaster within about 6 months to a year, and went from being well in a 70s approval rating to a 20s approval rating for George W. Bush. And I think he probably would worry that the same thing would happen to him. I could imagine some sort of military attack, however, either before the midterm elections next year, or if he's still around in 2020, I could imagine it during the election, perhaps during the primaries, in order to drive off potential primary challengers, of whom there certainly will be some on the Republican side. The North Korea crisis is a real thing. I mean, these missiles really are going to go, now can reach the United States, will soon be able to reach anywhere within the continental United States. And so it is a genuinely frightening situation, unlike the Iraq war, which was ginned up out of whole cloth, out of thin air. So I think he could sell that one probably pretty easily.
And I mean, of course, he's not going to take, or it seems highly unlikely that he would take what I think is a very reasonable offer from North Korea and China to suspend the nuclear program, their nuclear weapons program, in return for the suspension of the U.S.-South Korean joint military drills. But for a combination of reasons, I mean, there's the military-industrial complex on the one hand, there's these domestic political calculations. I think that's pretty unlikely. We have just about a minute left. Problems for Republicans don't automatically translate into increased support for the Democrats, right? I mean, do you think it's fair to characterize what we've been talking about, this declining support for Trump, as maybe more about dissatisfaction with the system as a whole, with the two-party system and the political establishment?
Absolutely. The story that people are barely talking about right now is the renewed civil war within the Democratic Party, between the Bernie Sanders progressive wing and the Hillary Clinton corporatist wing, which still runs the DNC. Now the war is about Kamala Harris, who seems to be, if the election were held tomorrow, would be the likely Democratic nominee. And she's being perceived by the Bernie folks as the second coming of Hillary Clinton for her ties to close ties to Wall Street banks and her failure to get behind reforms that would help working people, including a higher minimum wage and so on. So the Democrats are in disarray, and just because the Republicans are in a state of civil war, it's obscuring the fact that the Democrats are, in some ways, I would argue, suffering from greater structural problems.
That is unfortunately all the time we have. We've been joined from New York by award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist Ted Rall. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.